last night. So there's an agenda in front of you. Can we agree, members? One, on the cut of time. Two, on items that we feel should be prioritized. And then if we agree on the cut of time, any other business that was not dealt with tonight, then we can refer it tomorrow's morning. Yeah? We have a meeting at 9. And yeah, tomorrow will be better. So can we get proposals for cut of time? The DA Congress is conflicted. The chief whip is saying 6 o'clock. A member is saying 5:30. Then the ANC must decide for us. 8. There's a proposal for 8 o'clock. Mina, are you also moving for 8?
8 o'clock on the dot.
8 o'clock on the dot. Chief of the majority party?
Majority opposition party.
Majority opposition. I withdraw.
Thank you for the promotion. Chair, my meeting is a bit earlier than that. I've got to get to the Eastern Cape tomorrow, and I've still got some...
What time is
it? Probably around about 6:30, 6:45. And then, well, I'll try and stay a bit longer then. But I have a chief whip at home as well. It's also putting under pressure.
Apologies. Mr. Julius, Mr. Singh, Mr. Mulet Ali, Mr. Khadeze, Mr. Sheikh Imam, Ms. Labude. Those are the apologies. And I will now allow Mr. Moodley to take us through the strategic management and governance of the division. Oh, you have the division manager. You're welcome, Mr. Moodley, and we apologize for the inconvenience. Thank you very much. The stage is yours. Please take us through.
Sure. Good evening, chairpersons, members, and colleagues in the administration. I'm just going to move straight on to the objectives of my division. So the Strategic Management and Governance Division serves four key purposes, and it's not unique to Parliament, it's what strategic management is about. It enhances decision-making in the institution, both strategic and operational levels, advocates and enhances corporate governance, facilitates strategy execution and change management, and also drives innovation, strategic initiatives and projects to ensure more effective and efficient. So this comes straight out of Lindsberg and Michael Porter's theories of strategic management, and as I said, it's quite familiar across any institution. Then, just an introduction to the division. The Strategic Management and Governance Division came together probably as a division in 2016. I think that started 1st December 2016. The components of, I'm going to use SMG for short, for strategic management and governance. The components of SMG operated independently before, and the components comprised of the strategic planning office, your enterprise project management office, your policy monitoring unit, and the risk management office. And the it was quite a priority to actually get these sections to operate in an integrated manner. And so I still say that there's an emphasis on teamwork and collaboration within the division, so that we have an integrated approach to strategic management within the institution and to unlock synergies. Then, on the purpose of the SMG division, before we go into the purpose, if you look at Parliament's finance, the FMPPLA, it talks about the tabling of a 5-year strat plan, producing annual performance plans, reporting. A lot of that work is done in the SMG division, and so a lot of the things that even this committee sees, a lot of the quarterly reports, those kind of things, annual reports even, would come out of the SMG division, and we facilitate that to a great extent. primarily lead to enhanced decision making. We facilitate strategic and governance processes. We publish governance documents. We do project and program management services, risk identification and risk management services, assurance services, what I would call business intelligence and analytical services, and the monitoring evaluation of strategy implementation. Another view of this is so we can package SMG's service offering into the category. So strategic advisory services, and I've listed what gets done there. Publication of institutional government documents, also in that, and what I've broadly call assurance services, which would be compliance and evaluation type services. And I think just to cover a few things besides the service offering, some of the things that we need to do is provide policies and frameworks relating to broadly strategic management, best practices in selling and operating procedures, process advisory, facilitation of sessions, workshops, coordination, and collaboration, strategic alignment across the various areas of them to so that it can operate as a holistic entity. And I think the other ones I covered earlier. So let me just move on to. I think I want to move straight on to the value chain. This is another way of actually looking at what the division does. So if you look at what the outcomes in village does, I think this is slide number 9, the outcomes in village by the SMG division, it would be achieving the outcomes in Parliament through what we could typically need to do in increasing the management maturity of the institution. We do strategy development and formulation, and there is a focus on strategy execution. So the value created by SMG would be so if your strategic management is working properly, it allows for better decisions in the institution. And the theory is that better decisions result in value creation. So that would be the position outcome that my divisional value chain links into that of the institution. And I think this is not specific to Parliament. It would be what a strategic management area does anyway. Then I would move on to key performance areas in my division. So obviously, Parliament does have an FMPPLA, and there are prescripts in the FMPPLA. So that talks about the tabling of performance reports, the tabling of StratFam, the tabling of APTs. So since it's done by my area, compliance to that would be one of the key performance areas. Then we talk about the number of governance documents prepared in line with that. And then some of the moves that we've been doing, which are, I know from when, I mean, some of the things that have been introduced now, it's no longer looking at just whether a governance document was prepared, but we actually need to look at the quality thereof. So there's a strive to improve the quality of these, and also information supporting decision making. There's an emphasis on the quality of that decision support. And the last one, it's probably the hardest one to explain, but any institution can be viewed from a perspective of how strategically mature it is. Right? Where different industries have got varying levels of maturity, and there's a number of dimensions as to how that maturity is actually measured. The drive is to increase the strategic maturity of the institution. Some of them are objective benchmarks, but they are quite well-known models by which you measure this. And if you view the national treasury paradigm as being a 3.5 out of 5, whereas an institution like BP Shell or Wufuda, who do significant scenario planning, etc., and are very agile in their strategy, could be at a 4.5. So you can benchmark Parliament there, and it's a strive to increase that maturity through a number of processes. And I think move on to as the strategic management and governance division, there's a key set of stakeholders that you have to deal with, from the executive authority to even this committee. And we have to deal with this under that kind of perspective would end up here, and where there's a great need to coordinate across the institution, multi-dimensions of skills, and the other things which come out of even textbooks, they talk about projects have a limited time frame and scale, so it's not operation, it's not something you do on a day-to-day basis, it's things which catalyze your strategy. Then in Parliament, we also have a few other things which would state the coordination work would happen from here, from the running of SONAS to major. I think the HLP people, I've heard members talk about the HLP report, but the high-level panel of coordination had to be run from the project's office. There's no specific division which would have sat with that as their operational thing. So that would have been a catalytic project for the institution which sat within the project's office. I think the other thing which I need to state in all of those, where I've had greens versus yellows, green positions talk about permanent positions within the establishment, and yellow blocks represent people on contract. And so that's the other dimension which I need to bring up. Then I just want to give you an operational a view of my operational budget for the SMG operational budgets. So this slide, as it indicates, the operational budget for the components of SMG around 2014-2015 was, as you see there, about 3.6 million. Right? That's I joined in 2016, so I say SMG was established in 2016. You see that the top row of my slide. So my first budget that I got as a divisional manager for SMG was about 900,000. And over time, if you look at it's ordered from about 3.6 million to 629,000 over time, so that trend has been on a downward basis. So I do want to indicate that I would regard this as a downturn budget. And what you do in a downturn budget is you optimize your activities based on the allocated budget that you have, rather than your activities determining your budget. Because although the theory of we make plans and then we put budgets inside those plans, when you've got a significant downturn scenario in even a greater macrocosm, you do the maximum amount of activities or optimize the activities that you can do with the allocated budget. And that has been the realistic situation which I have been in for a long period of time. So I'm going to state outright that's how you do it. So we've looked for efficiencies, many new ways of doing things in order to be able to do more with less. And we'll continue to do so. Then I want to talk about focus areas in support of the ADP. I mentioned earlier that for any strategic management area, increasing strategic maturity of the institution is absolutely essential. So some of the things that we do is frameworks and guidelines, capacity development, interventions to for the institution to increase this. Then, because risk management is also under there, and it goes in tandem, that you also need to increase the risk management maturity of the institution so that the institution understands the trade-off risk that it makes, the risk in choosing to do something and the risk in choosing not to do something. And it needs to factor those into its decisions. So I've often heard value of money being talked about, but it's actually value at risk that you actually need to look at, because unless you bring that dimension in, it's not the full equation. So there are many institutions that use value at risk as a measure of which by which they define value creation for the risk that they're taking. So that level instructions will pass different resolutions. It's one of the things that it needs to be brought into the picture. And then alignment between skill match and roles. I mentioned risk maturity, and budget is a clear one I showed earlier. And an ideal operating model probably needs to be worked out. So I think I will stop there.
Thank you. In fact, you made it on time. Yeah. 15 minutes and 30. Okay. Members, can we get comments, questions for clarity, recommendations? Is there any? Okay. Yusoma? Kai? Yusoma and Kai for now.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you for the opportunity that probably let me also appreciate the informative presentation that has been made. But I'm going just to pick up the latter part of it, because it interests me that when you say that most people, they plan, monitor, and evaluate, then there's a next leg that is missing there. But also I want to add, to say probably also you need to add that what needs to be done, who, by when, so that then it's a complete exercise for us as an oversight body, that it will help us for better managing, but also better oversight role that we can do. Because you can think at a high level, but if it's not clear, predetermined objective with a clear line time frame, then it also is a fruitless exercise, it's a desktop exercise in a way. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'm just looking at the key performance areas and the targets. So how many targets do you have for the division? One. And also, how do you relate with the institutions here in Parliament? Institutions such as the institutions supporting democracy, the institutions like PPO.
Page 5. If you say it's purpose of the division, and then you say publication of the strategic plan, then submit monthly financial statement, quarterly performance report, mid-year budget and performance assessment. Annual report, and I want to know your relationship with the CFO, CFO's office. And then, page 7, I don't know whether those apply for us, but there's some way to say strategic plan, annual performance plan. And then the heading says services and products provided by the division. So the summer where you say quarterly performance report, mid-year, I don't understand what is the budget, what has the budget to do with services and products that you're providing. Can you also explain that? Are you following? Which page? Yeah.
I was guiding a challenge that I'm going to say this way. So I'm working we try to move towards that level of maturity where the emphasis is on course correction of strategy rather than reporting on it later why it failed or why it succeeded. So I think that's what I was trying to indicate. But I guess your point is there needs to be a plan around it, but it's not that if we are to put that capability, it needs some sort of decisions made around it. So that's number one. On the two, the relationship between the strategy division deals with all the various areas of the institution. I mean, you were asking about the institution supporting democracy, so interestingly enough, I was asked to look at the operational plan in the last 2 weeks, and I gave my comments around it. So we give guidance on the alignment because these various areas fit into a great strategy. So the operating plan, all divisions come to my area. We also look at strategic alignment between them and how they pull together. The PBO, I've had extensive engagements with the PBO, but the PBO, according to the Act right now, is outside the parliamentary administration. But on numerous occasions, including many times this year, I've had meetings with the PBO. I know exactly the kind of things that they are doing. And they often take advice on some of the plans, their operational plans that they draw up from the SMG division. So, another way to view it is that the strategic management division would be group strategy in another institution. And you'd have operational plans for various divisions. But they still need to come to a group strategy level for there to be alignment and for them to be working in tandem. So by natural course of our work, we actually work with all the divisions within Parliament. I don't know if I've adequately covered that one enough. On the last one, you asked me about why I call it products and services. So it's from the perspective of my division. When a quarterly report or a performance report is produced, or an annual report, it is a product of my division. It's one of, in our value chain, there are certain inputs that we use, there are certain skills we provide, but the document itself, like when you have an annual report, to us that would be a product. There are services that we need to provide also in the creation of that product. So it's simply from the perspective of my division. So that would end up as a published annual report, a tabled quarterly report. So it's just simply a product and service that my division provides. So it's what the end user would see. On the question of the chief financial officer is my colleague, and we work very closely together on those things. Responsibility for finance and budget lies there, and responsibility for strategy. But you would see that a lot of the presentations which even come to this what have got both your performance information and they have budgetary information. And the CFO and I have to work together on that consistently across the always. It has never been an issue, and that's how we work together on those things. And there is a great relationship between what is strategy and performance versus the budget that goes with it. So we integrate our work a lot. Okay. Do you know if I have something else?
Mr. Solot,
management. We are in government. This is a public project. So, and for me, then I'll start from the base of the response. But also, I'll try to be polite. In terms of the objective of this decision, in page 3, it says that one is to enhance decision making in institutions, which is government, in terms of parliament, both strategically at a high level and also operational at what makes government or parliament fit that operation. Two, it advocates that it goes on and on. But in terms of operational level, you must have the targets that are, you must also oversight and measure them and make suggestions how to improve according to the laws that governs us. So I just want to make it clear that. Two, Chair. The other one that I want to talk to is the issue of that. I totally agree, but don't forget that we are in Parliament. Parliament has but also he's correct to say you need to move from just monitoring and evaluation. There's another leg that is lacking. So I totally agree with him. But that leg, the remedial action is the corrective measure. That needs then a measurable thing that you can measure so that you say this is what needs to be corrected. And who's accountable? Because there must be somebody who's accountable. So while we're at a technical high level operational, but in terms of the division of objective chain, that's why I think that it's probably necessary for people that space to be on the same page in terms of that, and to be fine. So that moving forward also, we'll be able also to ask the department in terms of the new dispensation of the Swiss Parliament, to so how best then can you satisfy our communities as well. Because we're not servicing only ourselves. In the Parliament, in terms of different divisions and units, but also, thank you so much.
I have a question with regard to the relationship with the institutions. There was no clear response with regard to the PPO. I wanted to find out if the division is aware of the challenges that the PPO is facing, and also what is it that is doing the division at the strategic level to address the challenges that are faced by the PPO.
Let me thank you very much, Co-Chairperson. The function of Mr. Mungi, his division, each one of us as divisions, we draw up our ACTs. And those are costed and are driven by strategic objectives. Let me start from what we're doing. The NCOP has done its planning session. The NA is going to do its planning sessions around the priorities. Our work will then be to pull together the priorities and define the strategies for the fifth parliament, out of which we have measurable objectives. The work of Mr. Moody is to pull together that document. In that document, there are targets that are quarterly targets that we're going to come and report to you. Those targets will say research, said the deliver research advice to members in 7 days. So they are timed, and next to that, each division has got targets. And at the end, every quarter we then see how we match the targets. That's one. Second thing, what the division does, indeed they refine our indicators as to how do we measure. So they will come to us and say, look, this statement, how are you going to measure that? So many people have heard about Parliament. Communications will say we're going to do an independent survey where we find out from the public whether they know about Parliament or the local Parliament and can they access Parliament. Their work as strategy and management governance is to pull together that document and make sure that we have descriptor indicators, we have measurements, and we say how we measure it quantitatively, qualitatively, and so on. So they put together one single document. So our ATPs, after the plans of the 2 years, we produce the strategy. But remember now we've had an APP 2020, 31st of, which was submitted last year, 31st of May, in terms of the plan. So we need to go back after the planning of this new term of the 6 months. We need to go back to that APP, look at whether it's relevant with respect to the outcomes of what members want should be achieved and how we support that achievement. So his function is to make sure that the strategic objectives are defined correctly, they have got measurements, quarterly they are covered, and someone is responsible. So that's what men is asking. And when you come, we present to you on a quarterly basis. That table, when he's talking about services, that report is then tabled, and when we table it, we submit to both the chamber speaker, sign it off, and then ATC. So that's the process of processing that. So that's exactly what he's talking about. And under this division, we also have a risk office, so we do develop the risk register for each division and mitigation statements. We even have an institutional risk register. Included in that, honorable members, is we have the budget. So we report, it's not perfectly integrated, but we will show you that this quarter, in terms of projection, we were projected to spend this much against this particular target. We haven't because of certain things. Or, taking parliament to the people is coming, there's an allocated budget to the NSOP and so on and so forth. So you'll see the whole picture of possibly, because he's presenting what he's doing, Mike is not showing there, but narrated there, but what he is responsible for is to put together a strategy, quite a strategy of parliament, which has got strategy objectives and everything else. Thanks. With respect to the PBO, the act was amended last year, December, I think, that PBO does not report to the accounting of parliament anymore. It's got an advisory council, and therefore their strategy, their APP and everything else has to be signed off, presented, discussed with the advisory council in terms of the act. So we have no role in it at all. Before December. But before that, we would have that strategic objective in the APP, and they reported on the type of reports they provide to the different committees, analytical reports, budget analysis, and so on and so forth. So you will see in the APP, we still have their strategic objective on the turnaround time, the number of reports submitted. We still had it up until, I think the last quarter of the House financial year. Thanks, Kosha.
Thanks for the clarity. Honourable Chair?
No, just on that, where do they get the money from? Straight from the treasury or through Parliament?
You must please allow me to respond. Unfortunately, the PBO, like the Office of the OFD, those are mandates that were not funded. So the PBO gets budget from our baseline. We allocate budget. We've been asking for the funds from National Trail for the past 3.5 years, we have not gotten it. So we give them a portion of what we can from our baseline. And that's a matter that's been sitting on the agenda of National Trail for as many years as we've been asking. Thanks.
What? Mr. Mokhi? Is there anything that you want to add?
Of the operational, so I think one of the things, small things to mention, is besides the ADP, etc., each division has an operational plan, and they have operational indicators. So what I reflected to you was simply the operational indicators for my division. But every single division, we facilitate that, every division and any of the divisional managers you've heard have got their operational plans with their operational indicators, which get tracked. They're not at an ADP level, because we couldn't have, let's say, 50 indicators necessarily in the APP. Even National Treasury states, a certain number is advisable, and then the others are more operational indicators, but we do have them. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. Can we now move to Human Resource Management Division? We'll prioritize if you are ready. It's going to be followed by the core business support division. You have 15 minutes to present. 15 minutes.
in terms of the purpose of the division is there to ensure that the institution is able to attract the required skills, develop current employees and retain employees whose competencies are critical to the organization, as well as to create a conducive environment for engaged and productive workforce. Also, the division also manages wellness support to members of parliament. Next slide. In terms of the services delivered by the division, one, we manage the wellness support to members of parliament and employees in the administration. An example that I'll unpack that later on. We manage the on-site emergency medical service, which is a clinic, the comprehensive counseling service. Number two, we provide human resource administration. Now, ensure that we send the payment of salaries and benefits to employees, management of employee information and records. Number three, the acquisition of talent that Parliament requires, and that basically talks to recruitment and selection, onboarding of employees. The number four is the development of employees to ensure that Parliament has the skills it requires to successfully execute its plans. And in there, what we are referring to are examples such as the awarding of bursaries that we provide in the institution, the structured training in line with personal development plan. Number five is the creation of a conducive environment enabling employees to achieve their performance goals and their potential. In this case, we are talking about the employee implementation of a performance management system, maintaining good working relationships with organized labor, annual employee engagement survey. And finally, we provide the design and implementation of organizational development interventions to improve organizational effectiveness. In particular, we're talking about re-engineering of business processes amongst others. When we go to number 3.1 in terms of the wellness support to members and employees, the human resource division is tasked with, as I've said, we basically manage the on-site clinic. Now, the clinic is here to assist members and employees when they are injured on site by treating them and referring to hospitals where necessary. The clinic also monitors members and employees' chronic illness like diabetes and blood pressure. We also manage, although now this is this work is done by a company called Metropolitan Services, which provides counseling services. Now that is to employees and to members of parliament. Now this is the services both in terms of face-to-face and also telephonic support by qualified and accredited professionals. The service covers support such as psychosocial well-being, health support, financial well-being, and legal well-being. Now, also as part of the wellness support, we also coordinate a number of sport and recreational activities within the institution. We have about 20 sporting goals where members of parliament as well as staff participate. And also, twice a year, we run what we refer to as wellness days, also for members and for staff of parliament. Now, when I go to slide number 7, which talks to the human resources administration, we are tasked with basically the payment of salaries and benefits to the 1,312 existing employees, but also we process post-retirement medical benefits to former employees. And I also just wanted to highlight the fact that in terms of our payment structure, as the parliamentary service, we are on total cost of employment, which is all inclusive. We also manage employment records and information, and also we maintain human resource policies and procedures. Number 3.3 talks to the acquisition of talent, and that basically is about recruitment and selection. And one of our targets in terms of that of deliverable is actually to manage the target that we've been having for the past 3 years. Is to manage our vacancy rate to within 10%, and we're able to achieve that for the past two financial years. 2017-2018, our vacancy rate came out at 9.9%, and for 2018-19 at 9.2%. to clarify why that slightly higher percentage. One of the reasons is the fact that between obviously with the new parliament, at the end of the parliament, a number of colleagues were attached to the term of office of the previous presiding officer, their term of office ended. So a number of the colleagues left the institution. But second, we've had a situation where a number of our colleagues reached what we call, in line with our pension scheme. We have two pension schemes, the government employee pension fund and the pension scheme for the officers of parliament. In terms of the pension scheme for officers of parliament, once employees reach 25 years service, employees have the opportunity to take early retirement. We've had a number of employees actually reaching that 25-year milestone, and we've had a couple of them actually taking early retirement. We've actually captured information in terms of the vacancies according to various branches. As you know, we actually have really two main branches, the core business branch and the support branch. In terms of the number of vacant positions, active vacant under core business, we have 51. Vacancies, we have 617 filled positions, and the vacancy rate for core business is 7.63%. Now, core business includes your knowledge and information services, your core business area, which is where your community support is, where your community is. And your content advisor, legal services also forms part of that, international relations forms part of the core business. The support services branch, that is where you have HR, you have institutional support services division, you have parliamentary communication services, you have ICT, and you also have institutional support services division. The number of vacant positions is 85, we have 506 positions that are filled, and the vacancy rate there is 14.38. And then you then have the administration branch, which is basically including the office of the secretary, but also the offices of the presiding officers that are placed in that branch, as well as, for example, other offices like your internal audit, your SMT, form part of the administrative branch. Now, also, I think I've highlighted the issue of the early retirement. I've highlighted the issue of the end of contract. We have also had resignations, but also the issue of funding. We do have a challenge in terms of funding, such that not all the vacant positions have funding. So, as such, as the administration and linked to the needs of the presiding officers and the members of parliament, we have focused, and you see that in terms of the table, the focus has been more on the core business branch to make sure that we fill those positions that are vacant in the core business branch area, and then obviously followed by the support services. So priority has always been up to date that we prioritize the core business branch in terms of the filling of positions, and hence the figures are showing. But also, one of the issues that is leading to some of the vacancies, especially at a higher level, it's not as easy to fill some of the senior positions. One of the processes that we have followed and we had to re-advertise was the process of filling positions like your CIO, your CFO positions. We went to re-advertise again because we've added the headhunting element. It was the first time around we tried and we didn't get the sufficient response and the quality of employees or candidates that we could actually make offers to. So that's also one of the challenges as well, that it's not always that easy to fill positions within the ideal 12. It's our target in filling positions, and we're able to achieve that in the previous financial year, is 12 weeks. So we strive to fill positions within 12 weeks, but in some cases, given the scarcity of some of the skills, it becomes a bit difficult to do that in 12 weeks. Under employee growth and development, like I've mentioned earlier, that as part of our employee growth, we do provide terms of the levels in the institution. The A to C band, that is the bargaining unit. Then your D band, that is where you have your, in terms of public service levels, that's where you have your directors and chief directors. And the E to F, that's where you have your typical level, deputy director general, as well as the secretary to parliament, who is at the director general level. So that picture basically gives a picture of the boundaries that we have given for the whole of the fifth term of parliament. In addition to that, every year we bring on board a number of interns to give them exposure for a period of a year in the institution. Just this past year we had about 21 young graduates who were with parliament, and the internship ended at the end of July. In addition to that, again, we have put in place management development programs that colleagues have also used throughout the institution. Number 3.5 talks to the creation of a conducive work environment. We are tasked with managing the labor relations climate in the institution. And we just wanted to also highlight the fact that the current labor relations climate is stable, and that can be seen with in terms of the graph that we are showing at the bottom there. That shows the number of disputes that we both referred internally and externally to the CMA. If one looks at the employee relations incident, one can see a picture where we actually have a decline from, especially if you look at around 2015-2016, where we had a serious challenge that led to a strike in the institution. We had about plus minus 50 incidents of labor relations. But since then, with the efforts that we put in place, we started seeing a reduction. In 2017-18, we had only 23 incidents. And in 2018-19, we had only 14. And I also maybe need to also just highlight that what was also positive is that in the previous financial year, for the whole year, we didn't have any case that was referred to the CMA by whether employees or within organized labor, whereas previous would have plus minus 18 cases that were referred to the CMA. So efforts where management and labor put in place some processes to engage on a regular basis, we engage on a monthly basis, maybe to try to stabilize the relationship between management and labor, are actually very close. Then in terms of organizational effectiveness, we are basically tasked with facilitating interventions that are aimed at improving the effectiveness of the institution. And some of this relate to, again, the change management with regards to, for example, the introduction of various systems, such as your ERP system. The HR division also supported the introduction of the My Parliament app, which was providing support to members of Parliament. But we also introduced that one of the reasons that one could also highlight as being one of the reasons why every year we are able to increase, especially for the past 3 years, we are able to manage our vacancy rate within 10%. It has to do also with the system that we put in place. We have a system that is called iRecruitment, and that system has actually revolutionized how we do our recruitment processes. In the past, the recruitment process was mainly manual. So we got to a point where CVs would be lost. In some cases, it would take time to go through the ranking and the scoring of CVs. So with the introduction of the system, panels can actually do everything on the system. So you can track when colleagues are actually taking longer than the time that is required to fill positions. We are busy with the performance management system automation. Still in part manual based, so colleagues are still completing their contracts in part manually, but we are working on also automating the system. We also provided support in terms of a project that was focusing on creating an integrated support system to members of parliament, where members will receive a one-stop service, and I think my colleague Mr. Mabuso will talk to that. The HR team worked in terms of making business processes to enable that process to and which talks to the issue of the feeling of vacant position. It's over. Can I finally finish this? Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much. So the first one obviously relates to the issue of funding. It is a challenge to understand that as the administration, we've been trying by all means to make sure that we prioritize certain positions that we know that the institution will require so that we become effective. I think the positive to it is the fact that it has stretched us to become innovative and creative and optimally utilize the resources that we have. That is the positive side. And again, second to that, we have also gotten to a point where we are looking at other options, such as following what the speech by the Minister of Finance, the consideration of early retirement for some of the colleagues that have reached certain ages and are ready to take on early retirement. So we are busy with that process, and we are working closely with organized labor in terms of that process. The organizational realignment project, also that project is aimed at optimally utilizing the skills that we have in the institution. I'll give an example. You have your currently the setup is that you have a researcher, a committee, you have a content advisor, a committee. Now you have a researcher on the National Assembly side who provides support to the portfolio committee and researchers on the National Council. Now, a challenge there is that in some cases, you don't have enough on both sides. And to find that actually those colleagues, if we had them in a particular setup where they were providing more patient support, that would work better. Instead of actually having them in different areas, that would give them the potential of any duplication. So our re-engineering process is already picking up some of those things. I can also give you an example about an exercise in HR. We have done a restructuring in HR, and the re-engineering process within HR has allowed us to reduce the number of positions from 60 to 39 positions as we speak now, and even the payroll. So we've also seen that the process is starting to bear fruit around actually ensuring that we optimally utilize the skills that we have. Finally, is the skills audit exercise that we also undertook earlier this year. Again, the aim of that is, over time, like I mentioned earlier, that we will be offering bursaries. So we have received bursaries over the years. But one of the gaps that we have not actually dealt with and we are starting to deal with now is optimally utilizing those skills that colleagues have acquired when they go to universities and taking content to acquire their qualifications. So through this process, is to identify what are other skills that we have now as police have acquired over time, such that in case of advertising positions, we can use those skills from within the organization. Co-chairperson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the presentation. Okay. Stenhaven. Hi. Lesoma. In that order.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I'd just like some clarity from the Human Resource Department if they're responsible for disciplinary procedures as well in terms of employees. I'm just going to get clarity. Is that your responsibility for the department? It is. I'd just like to get some clarity why it's taken us nearly 3 years to conclude the disciplinary procedures against the Secretary's department. Say to one of the goals of the department is to create a conducive working environment. I would say it's not a conducive working environment. An acting Secretary of Parliament for nearly 3 years while this disciplinary has dragged on, and clearly we need to look at our HR procedures that we don't end up with a situation where people are allowed to just drag the process out for nearly 3 years on full pay. It's destabilised the institution. There's uncertainty still to this day about what's the outcome or where that process actually is. So if we can get some clarity there. And just in terms of page 9, or slide 9, the bursary issue there. We had discussed in the 5th Parliament there was going to be a revising of the bursary policy, because the policy that was given to the committee was a policy that dated back quite some time, and it was unclear about who could sign off bursaries for particularly senior management. I noticed in 2017 there were two that were awarded. I presume one of those was the bursary provided to the Secretary of Parliament. And I would just like to find out if indeed he is found guilty and dismissed, whether we would be able to recoup the money that was provided for the MBL studies of the Secretary of Parliament. And there was also Ms. Ntia, who we had paid a significant amount of money towards the bursary, who was studying abroad, whether she is still in the employ of Parliament. If not, if she's not in the employ of Parliament, has there been any effort to recoup any of the funds that that Parliament expended on her studies at Columbia University? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Co-Chair. Just a few questions. Firstly, I think with regard to the vacancies, at least if you could have a breakdown of the grades of the grades that are affected, so that we have a view, particularly the senior management level, how the vacancy rate it is. And I see that, okay, with regard to the resignations, I don't know if there are any interviews before this, when people are tendering their resignation, so that you know what are the reasons why they are resigning. Could be also the what the Honorable Skin is saying about the environment. So could be some of them have such a... But I feel you say nothing about this salaries. I assume therefore they are not dismissals in Parliament, because there's nothing in the report about dismissals. So the environment is conducive. Also the percentage of employees with disability, there's nothing with regard to that in the report itself. And then percentage of women in senior management positions. I see that you're talking about engaging the Treasury and the PSA with regard to early retirement. But my understanding is that Parliament has got nothing to do with the PSA. Why are you engaging the PSA? Because you, even with the salaries and working conditions, you directly negotiate with the unions, not via the PSA, what is it, public service. At some stage there was an issue in Parliament about the vetting of staff. That issue has been resolved now. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Probably this one is a bias question, as it were. Who manages the members of Parliament development, as it were? That's one, administratively. That's one. Two, Chair, I'm sure you'll agree with me, even the acting secretary to Parliament, that 40% is above the acceptable percentage, as it were, in terms of vacant posts. Some of that would be, are these vacant posts budgeted for? But don't respond today, you can respond it through the co-chairs in writing through Yahoo's co-chairpersons on this one, because it's a little bit detailed. So I'll urge that they don't respond to it, but to say take note that we'll get through the email. And how long have been those posts been vacant? Because it will talk to whether we need them or not, or we need to review our organogram, as it were. Four. Okay. I love this one. It's a comment. The automation of KPI. I know I read it yesterday in a different way, but also what I love about this one is that in future, when you are coming back to us through you, coaches, honorable coaches, that just give us a turnaround time so that it can matter. It cannot be a moving target, which doesn't have turnaround time. because our role is also in oversight. You can't oversight on something that you can't measure. The other one, which goes to through your chair, probably the best placed at the door of the acting parliamentary secretary is the training of all parliamentary workforce on battlefield principles within the KPA, within the work skills plans as it way. But the other one I'll leave it because I was tempted to say in terms of the pending or the status quo of the secretary to parliament, probably the relevant individual needs to comment on that, but you are better paid to consider that part. But I'm not too sure in this room if anyone who can say that, because in terms of interviews also and the process and where the issue is, probably in the next meeting, so the honorable good co-chairs will answer to that. And I don't know, because I'm not using the history, because I've never been part of this committee, forgive me. Those members who have been here before. But also the other one, which is generic, that I would like to raise, is that we must remind you when we recruit that we respect the demographics and the gender. What do you call it? Gender equity, as it were, in terms of the country. Because it's very clear in terms of the constitution and so forth that we must respect that. Thank you so much.
Sorry, I just forgot one of my questions, if I may ask. It's on 3.5, the creation of a conducive work environment. If I could just understand what the markers are that are used to measure a conducive work environment. It surely can't just be TCMA, appeals, etc. I know, for instance, anecdotally from speaking staff, that there's a great deal of stress in the institution around short staffing and people having to carry big workloads in a number of key departments, which is not a conducive environment. We had the very tragic incident which happened on the precinct where a member of staff committed suicide at work. These are all markers to me that something is not a conducive work environment. So I'd just like to find out from you how your department measures a conducive work environment, what those measurements are. Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam
Chairperson. I think most of the parts have been covered. Unfortunately, they are numbered. Page 6, where you speak about the wellness support to members of parliament and employees in the administration. And here, maybe I'm being subjective because I'm conflicted. I'm looking at myself and on these services that you say you give, more especially this one of financial well-being, advice, budget, debt review, and whatever. I've been here for 5 years and I haven't benefited from that. But maybe as time goes on, we can engage each other on how best can we make the service available to everyone to be accessible. On slide number 8, Honorable Bissouma has spoken about that. And I'm happy that you have a 12 weeks as your time frame for you to process the ceiling of the King's School. Because with that, we will be able to identify if there's a problem being an oversight body, but also yourself will be able to see if you are effective, is the strategy working or not, and if it's not working, what is it that you need to change. On the vacancies, you say active vacant posts. Just need a clarity. If you say they are active, are these budgeted or funded posts that are vacant? Because below they say because of retirement, ill health, and other related issues. And I want to believe that these are funded posts. Have you looked into the strategy of how quick, because in public service, having been in public service, you know, it takes forever, if it does take place, to make a replacement, for lack of a better word that I can think of. If somebody retires, or somebody resigns, or due to death, for you to fill that post as a public service takes forever. But I'm happy that you say, for you it takes 12 weeks. But let's work around these vacancies, because if these vacancies are funded, and I think in your O'Connor grant, you don't have unfunded posts. Because if you have that, you used to have that previously, and it was misleading, because you will be tongue-lashed that you have high vacancy rate, and in the real sense, your vacancy rate is not high. But here, I think we talk about the active one, which are funded. Let's work on the strategy. Let's get a strategy on how are you going to make sure that we fill in these positions, because they're budgeted for, and I think they are needed. In our engagement throughout, we've been saying you are overstretched as Parliament in terms of your workforce. So it's one thing that I think in our next engagement, when we do quarterly reports and stuff, we need to be updated in terms of the process. How far are we? The issue of the acting secretary, if it, I was in another forum, I was going to say, can the secretary, because we are talking about you or affected, be excused from the meeting, but not here. No? Like I said, if you were in another forum, this meeting was for something. But I think we are being unfair to the institution, to the person concerned, and to our recipient of our services, the people that are citizens. Because when you act, no matter how capable you are, there's some sense of, at some stage, you'll experience a problem sometimes in terms of decision making, because you're 18. And all of us who are looking forward to grow, because you think these decisions might, you know, disadvantage me as time goes on. The stability of the institution itself. That's why when we debate there and whatever, and we'll say, is this a Hollywood where everybody's acting? I think I heard somebody said, or was it you, saying the CFO is also acting. So there's no stability in such an organization, because we need people who are appointed who have powers and legally, and they can take decisive decisions. The functioning also, Jay, it doesn't work out. Maybe one needs to understand what is the process of, I don't know if that you are an HR specialist, you might be able to advise here. What is the process of appointing a secretary for that matter? Because I don't know if the acting secretary will be able to advertise or be involved in the process of appointing an acting CFO if herself is not appointed as acting. I don't know. You can advise on that one. And for how long has been the CFO acting? issue of the, okay, on the issue of the PDO, it's clarified, we had a session in the morning, clarified that there's no more reporting to the faculty, but still part of the family, but the reporting direct to the political leadership, which is something that we have taken a resolution on how to attend to it. The shared service, I'm not clear if this is going to benefit profitably the parliament, but I also understand that you cannot make it clear today. In the morning session, we have suggested that we will need an induction session, but not a one-off induction, continuous. Because the majority of us, if not all of us, we are new, it's only Honorable Stephen Haven, who is a continuing member in this committee. So we will need the induction to have a broader understanding of the issue, how do we operate as parliament, what is expected of us, because it becomes difficult for us as the oversight board to oversight on something that we ourselves don't understand. So that will be very important. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Just to add on the acting issue, yesterday we had a presentation from the Auditor General, and they told us they presented to us about the amendment that they made on the public. Yeah, so it's a very controversial issue. It talks about material irregularities. So let's say they come later on, then they say you paid the acting secretary, she's been paid. And also you suspended the secretary, and the secretary was also paid. So there's an irregularity there. I mean, if you act from 2017 to 2019, I mean, labor laws, what are they saying about that? And already expectations have been created. I would feel very bitter if you were to appoint somebody else when I've acted for more than 3 years. I would feel very, very bitter. Well, I don't know. I'm not saying she would feel like that, but personally, I would not be happy with that. So, you are an Asian specialist. Please tell us, labor laws, what are they saying in terms of acting? It's an issue that needs to be resolved, maybe before the next financial year. We need to really advertise and move on. We recommend that we should start with the process with immediate effect, so that when we speak to departments, we should also be able to be taken seriously. We cannot want to treat Parliament differently, and when we get to the department, in fact, this thing will never happen in the department, not in our presence. Never. It doesn't. So we don't want departments to be treated in a certain way, but when it comes to Parliament, we want to act differently. We are all governed by laws, so let's do the right thing. So it's a recommendation. We want this process to start as early as yesterday. Some of the programs that you've mentioned, they clash with the Institutional Support Services Division. I don't know what is your relationship with them, and if you can just clarify that. And then when you gave the figure of the people who are actively involved in the bursary program, you said colleagues. So colleagues, I am not sure whether you meant everybody, including members. My interest would be to know how many members are active in that scheme, because it was mainly made for members. Your colleagues are benefiting in terms of the extension, but it's not their program, to be honest. So we just in kind and we've extended. So
So we want to know how many members of parliament are benefiting out of that, and if the percentage is too low, we want to encourage members to take advantage of that facility. It's very important. There's something that I don't know whether you'll be able to respond about, is the in the insurance scheme for members. Is it within your division? It's not. Okay, fine, it's not within your division. Not pension, insurance, the death. It's not. Okay, it's fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the members for their decision and for the call suggestions. Maybe let me also start with the last question. Firstly, with regard to the issue of mother, the boundaries that HR and relates to the staff, the boundaries and the training as it relates to members falls under the members' support services. So that is where the issues of the insurance for members would be then covered. In terms of the issue of the scheme, I think the challenge in a case like this is that I think especially obviously one, and I take the direction by the committee. I think one of the challenges that from an HR point of view, an institution finds itself in this case, especially when you are in a disciplinary inquiry, is that the disciplinary process can go either way. So the secretary could be found innocent, and in that case, the decision is must come. You will take a decision now and go through a recruitment process, you appoint a person, you may find yourself.
No. Whether he's going to be found guilty or not, you must start where you're supposed to start. If it's about disciplining him and finding him guilty or not guilty, the process must begin. We're not saying you must recruit, but we say start, do something. From tomorrow going forward, we want to hear something that something has been done. If there are disciplinary processes that are still pending, we want that process to start.
Chairperson, if you allow me, Chairperson, the process of appointing a secretary to parliament is not an HR process. It is an appointment by the executive authority of parliament.
Before we put the issue, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
We're not appointing the secretary to parliament. We want the hanging case, a disciplinary case against the secretary of parliament to be concluded. That's what we want.
Then
after that, there is another process.
Yes, ma'am. That's fine. But that process, it is not administration process. It is that of the executive authority. The HR is not involved in the discipline of the accounting of the parliament. The person in that position belongs to the executive authority. It is maybe a conversation that the committee has to have on the executive authority, honorable standing members, that all the progress reports around the disciplinary are communicated through the executive authority and the co-chair. So with respect on honorable members, I think it's a matter that has to be raised by the executive authority.
It's fine. We'll write a letter. We'll write a letter. Yeah? Yeah. Oh, they're coming next week. So maybe the agenda is part of what we'll put in the agenda. Okay.
If I could just help the House, the rule is quite clear in Saudi regulations, in court judgments, that an acting position may not be shorter than 2 weeks and may not be longer than 3 months unless it's specifically extended. So to have an acting person a year or two down the line is absolutely ridiculous. And it's contrary to our law. So it cannot be longer than 3 months and the specific extension to 6 months. Can't just float into that, so we need to take action.
It's fine, let's pass this item. We'll then entertain it next week, they are coming. It's
before the committee. Yeah. On the 11th.
Yeah, I'm happy to park it. And you're absolutely right, and thanks for the clarity. But I can tell you what's going to happen. It's going to be the same thing that we've been told for the last four times, that we've been told it's going to be finished in April. That's the result. And then April, and then it's going to be started in May, and then it's going to be concluded in June. And every one of those deadlines that we've been given in the past has not been met. So I would ask that in the notification to the executive authority that we would like some definitive timelines for the process to unfold, because otherwise you're going to be told the same thing, it's going to be finished at the end of November. I believe the contract expires anyway at the end of November. The acting secretary's, the secretary's contract with Parliament expires. But you know what you can't do is the contract expires and the disciplinary process is not completed yet. That has always been the concern. So I think that you're on the right track, and we need to get some definitive timelines on that.
Okay, before we give back to HR to respond. First, like I said, with your experience, it will assist to tap into that. But I want us to go to that meeting, the positive, to say the intention is to change. It's good that you're sharing with us what has been happening, and we must change that, because we can't keep on shifting the goalposts continually. We will make it clear when we request the executive to come to the meeting to say we also want the executive to clearly update the committee on, in as far as the case in relation to the Secretary of Parliament as to how far it is, and we'll take it from there. But I'm requesting that let's be positive and think of how best can we change that experience, because it's not helping anyone anyway. At the end of the day, we will be taking each other to court unnecessarily. Why do we have regulations in place that are guiding us as to what to do, how to do it, and when, how long should we take? Thank you, Chair.
The Honourable Co-Chair Mahlangu, we have covered the point, but I just want to bring the point that Honourable Co-Chair Mabe raised also, that in communication with the executive, inviting them through your good offices, do also raise the issue of the expectation that has been created, legally speaking, as it were. I think those are the valid points, so that we don't take them by surprise, because they might also downplay it. But we are very clear that that's what we want. We want also to be compliant with the laws that we have made ourselves. Thank you.
You may continue. Yeah. Just keep that one.
Okay.
Keep that question. Don't respond to anything.
No, thank
you. Related to that question.
Okay, thank you very much. I also came to accept the suggestions with regards to wellness, so that we can engage with your president. We also, in some cases, actually have been a bit worried that there's not been an uptake in some of the offerings. So, correctly, it's probably also how we have not reached out to the members to present what is on the offer. As well as the request that we come and update the committee on a regular basis with regard to the people who have been able to do that. penalty that they have to pay. So, in line with the minister's proposal, national treasury is to fund the penalty that the employee is required to pay. So that's why we're actually going as parliament to national treasury to check whether or not that would apply to us as well. Can it also include our employees? Because like I said, we have two schemes. One is already a closed scheme. We are not appointing people into that scheme anymore. It's called the parliament, the pension scheme for officers of parliament. It's an old scheme. The majority of our employees are on GPF. So to avoid us having to now, because this parliament is not budget for that, for the penalty. So we are engaging with that. So that is the on that. Exit interview, honourable member, yes, we do exit interviews, and also if required, we can give that information. And in fact, the information from exit interviews has helped us a lot in terms of looking the strategy to retain employees in certain categories. I'll give you an example. In the past, one of the areas that we were losing employees was with regards to fixed-term contracts of employment, especially as your G Venture Director, C Director. We used to have 5-year fixed-term contracts. Now, you have employees that come over after 3 years in, because now they are working 2 years to go. And others would misunderstand the advent, when we tell them, by the way, the interview, the five-year fixed-term, and they don't accept the post. So, with our engagement with the presiding officers in the big parliament, a policy was amended where your GPs are now permanent. So that comes from the exit interview. So that helps the exit interview as well. It will also be led to share analysis that comes from our exit interview. And then on the question of one of those cases I mentioned, I asked a question about Sunja. Ms. Nja resigned from Parliament last year already. She was the CIO. She resigned last year, and she did pay all the outstanding amounts in terms of the balance that was paid. So she did pay back the amount that was she was to pay to pay to us. Honorable coaches, I think I've covered all the questions identified. Dismissal. Yes, we don't dismiss anyone in the last five years. In fact, as we are talking about it, it was in the main, it was more exigent. We're not. And then the vetting process, we did have
just my question on the markers of a conducive work environment. What are the measurements that are benchmarks, given Mr. Gorani's suicide, given the workload, the stress that members of the administration are carrying?
Okay,
all right.
Well, before you answer that, this is something that I raised when we had our first meeting, I think, up in B454, and I was given a very general answer. I was told we'd get some feedback and we didn't. But now I'd like to ask you the question directly. It's come to my attention that there is a possibility that NA staff members and NCOP staff members are being paid on different scales or different rates. And I just want you to answer me now whether that's true or not. They should all be members of Parliament, should have the same, but there have been, okay, it's a sector. information has come to my attention that basically there is an issue about whether or not NA staff members earn different amounts of money to NCFE staff members. Could you just comment on that, please? Thanks.
Lastly, from my side, sorry, Dr.
Actually, the issue that one of the things is that there are actually specific cases, for example, in the questions division, to be specific, where employees in the NA are paid higher than employees in the NC company. The last point that I wanted also to raise is whether there are any plans or strategies to prevent employees being used as a parameter.
President has just signed a legislation that will, you'll be fined 5 years if you were to be found having misrepresented your qualifications. When are you going to start the process of verification of qualifications in Parliament, so that those who misrepresented their CVs should be punished?
Thank you, Coach President. Honourable Member, if I may start with the question of do we pay employees in the NA and NCOP differently? No. When we pay an employee, we pay in the post as a present. So let me give you an example. When before we attach a salary to a position is created. So a G1, for example, a G1 position, which in the public service would be equivalent to a director position, has the same minimum salary, whether it's in the NA or in the NCOP. So when you are appointed into that G1 position in the NA or NCOP, the minimum salary is exactly the same. In fact, it's exactly the same throughout the institution. When you have a different salary for a G1 in HR versus in NA or NCOP. So, where you would be paid differently, the colleague was just reminding me. So the only differentiator would be obviously in performance. So we will start near him at the same rate, we'll start at the same salary, the minimum salary. But when he performs, and he gets a notch progression, and I underperform, I obviously will not get a notch progression. That is where the difference is. But where we start off the minimum salary and the maximum salary scale that applies throughout the whole organization.
Okay, I need to follow up. So before we lose this, so then is that performance subjectively, qualitatively determined, or are there certain markers that you can point? Because you can understand, obviously, if people are being paid differently on based on your opinion of their performance, there might be dissatisfaction. But can you specifically say, well, you did A, B, and C, and therefore you performed and you didn't do da, 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 da? Are you able to do that, or is it very much your discretion?
No, discretion at all, honorable member. Every employee enters into a performance agreement in the organization. And they enter into a performance agreement with clear set of targets with their line manager, and there are reviews that take place, and where, for example, an employee feels aggrieved that the rating that they got is not what they are happy with, there are processes in terms of our performance management system where colleagues can actually appeal. So there is a formal performance management system. A colleague would sign and agree to those targets, and that is the basis on which they are evaluated.
Maybe there's a case in NCOP of...
Yeah, Chair, but I was going to say perhaps HR should investigate this one, this specific one, on the question section of both the NA and the NCOP, and perhaps report to this committee in the next meeting. I don't want him to be general.
are aware of that because the case that the Honourable Member is talking about, in the questionnaire, where there's no equality, no consistency on the questioning process. That case was submitted to my office and indeed given to the HR to work with Mr. Caso to establish exactly where the differences are. And it's been a long-standing case, I think. It's been quite a while. We're quite aware of that. Thank you very much.
Just the last one, Honourable Chair, is with regards to the question the Honourable Chair has asked around a conducive environment. Honourable Chair, that on an annual basis, we conduct climate surveys, and that is where the information with regards to areas that we must focus on, other than issues of dismissal. In fact, the dismissal, we always say we target to deal with the root cause of the concerns before we even get to where we deal with disciplinary issues. So we have climate service, and that forms part and parcel of our target on an annual basis. On the question of the verification, we have not yet put in place those processes. Obviously, because it's a recent decision taken by the president, but I'm very sure that as an institution will definitely be looking at that. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Mem. Basically, employees are not allowed to do business with Parliament. But also, one of the things that happens is that all the employees are required to complete the declarations, what we call this, the disclosure. So even if, for example, they were doing business elsewhere and not in Parliament, that information has to be disclosed. So it's not only for members.
Just a final question on this, but in relation to the investigation surrounding the staff member tragedy and suicide, has it been found in any way, and please I would be very mindful of your answer on this, that that matter was linked at all to these performance contracts and the difference in pay of staff? This is extremely serious. If you haven't concluded that investigation, please tell us that we'll be very careful about your answers.
Just to coach here through the climate survey, and I'd obviously like to just, maybe today's not the forum, but I'd just like to have this unpacked. Look at the percentage response from staff. What are the key issues that have emerged as concerns in that climate survey? And it's important that this committee pay for those because this committee, as you know, in the past has borne the brunt of a lot of the labour disputes that have happened. So I think it is important that at some later stage we perhaps have you back to unpack the last climate survey, for instance, so we can get an understanding of where the pressure points are for employees of the institution, so that we can be mindful of that when we take into account the macro picture of Parliament. I understand we're limited now with time, etc., so fully accept that, but I would like to unpack these climate surveys a little bit more.
Question, with your permission, the question with regards to the tragic event that happened in Parliament. Have not been called to respond.
We're having an item again on the 11th. The executive will be presenting to us on that issue. So, yeah, don't respond on it. Any other issues? Members, are you satisfied? Let's move on. Can we now get a briefing by the Core Business Support Division?
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Good evening, and good evening to honourable members and colleagues. My name is Rashida Beg. I'm the Division Manager for Core Business Support. And as for Mr. Woodley, I joined Parliament a year earlier on the 1st of December 2015. On my first slide, can you make your first slide? Thank you. Just to locate Core Business Support within the Core Business Branch. The division comprises the committee section, that is the committee section that's around to both the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. Also includes the Constitutional and Legal Services Office. And then we have a small office supporting the Leader of Government Business and then the Public Participation Area. The focus of the division is to provide procedural support to committees, funding support, secretarial support, logistical support, as well as legal support to all the committees of both houses, and legal support then is also provided to the parliamentary administration. They may also provide a legislative drafting service to committees and individual members. All in all, the division comprises 266 staff members. We also have a focus on another constitutional mandate of public participation, where our public participation team is responsible for rolling out public education programs, to make information available, and to facilitate access to support public participation activities, particularly of committees, but also on key projects that Parliament is involved in, and to certain activities of the House. We also play a key role, particularly in our core mandates of Parliament, of lawmaking, oversight, public participation, cooperative governance, and international engagement, to ensure that we provide the relevant information to support those core functions of Parliament. So our core objectives are then to provide a non-partisan support service to the committees of the Houses in relation to the lawmaking, oversight, public participation, and the other core mandates of Parliament. To this extent, we focus on implementing the oversight and accountability model of Parliament. This model is an old model. It's been developed in 2009. We've since, in the fifth Parliament, started reviewing this particular model, and we will be sharing a revised model with our members. Also, in this Parliament, the public participation model was adopted by the Joint Business Committee meeting towards the end of the fifth Parliament after we've incorporated recommendations from the high-level panel. Our core services provided by committees, and I do apologize, I haven't included the targets that were there in the fifth Parliament, but in essence, it focused in the committee section around the availability of minutes of the committee meeting, 3 days after the committee meeting, and in relation to the reports within 8 days after the committee meeting. And if I can just pause there, in the independent panel assessment of Parliament, there was a concern raised previously around the availability of minutes and reports, as well as the quality thereof. We have managed over the last 3 years to improve that performance from 26% to 65% over the last 3 years. It's ranged between 97 to 98%, and we've maintained that record. We've also managed to secure all the records in terms of depositing it on our Uzumba system. In addition, we have in the fifth Parliament started looking at codifying some of our practices, particularly in relation to the lawmaking process, and we have developed a draft lawmaking model, which we will be sharing with members as well. And in the same vein, looking at particularly cooperative governance and oversight in that area. And this is the next slide. What this slide depicts is essentially the oversight and accountability cycle, and to a large extent, then the support that the core business division provides. We start off with some SONA in the first quarter to the introduction of the budget process, the presentation of departmental strategic plans and the performance plan, the adoption of the division revenue, board appropriation board, moving us through to where we're heading in terms of the annual report process and budget review process. So the division is responsible to provide information, support services, legal support services, as well as public participation support services for all of these activities. Just in terms of a breakdown of the committee section, this is just a snapshot of the staffing component in the committee section, where we have the section managers supported by 5 unit managers, and then we have content advisors that are allocated to committees, committee secretaries, committee assistants. And we do have a peculiar office called the JCI, because this is a statutory requirement in terms of the intelligence legislation that we should have that particular office. So the focus of the committee section is then to provide those support services that we've listed there. In the public participation arena, our public participation section comprises a public education office, which is located within Parliament. Then we have a central parliamentary democracy office in Parliament, which supports three parliamentary democracy offices in the Northern Cape Province, in Limpopo and Northwest. And there was a pilot program for the establishment of the PDOs. There was a need to establish a footprint of Parliament, particularly in our deep rural provinces. The intention was then to create similar offices in the other parliamentary democracy offices, sorry, the other provinces. But a decision was taken due to budgetary constraints that we will maintain the three offices, and when we have sufficient budget, then to consider extending those offices so that we can improve our public participation endeavors and try and reach, if it's practically possible, 57 million citizens in the country. These offices also do assist that when we have committee activities, oversight visits, taking Parliament to the people, when we have committee public hearings on bills, then those offices will provide support in those provinces, with the PO office providing support in the remaining provinces. So I've given you just in a picture graph just the composition of the public participation section with the PO and PDOs. We also have the visitors program administrator, and one of the honourable members has requested access to the tour. We will encourage members to go on the tour, and if you do have visitors, we would like to share our precincts with your guests. The constitutional legal services offices, we have legal advisors that are allocated to committees to provide legal support in committee activities, be it with the lawmaking and oversight processes, so essentially providing legal advisory services. Then there's also legal drafting services offered, and we have had in the fifth parliament some bills that were generated through this office that have been passed in legislation. The office is headed by the chief legal advisor, supported by three senior legal advisors, and then we also have the bills office that's responsible for processing the legislation once it is referred by the executive, right up to the process where it is assented to by the president, and then deposited with the legal deposit drivers, including the constitutional court. The office of the leader of government business is a very small office. I'm told that it is a young office, but essentially the office was created to establish a nexus between Parliament and the executive. So there's coordination of the parliamentary program and government program, and this is the role of this office, to maintain that nexus, to coordinate communication to the executive of what is happening in Parliament, when are they sitting, which clusters have to be in the House to answer questions, etc. And in the same vein, also to establish what legislation we can expect to receive from the executive. As offices, as well as a coordinator and administrative office. Just in terms of budget allocation, the division's budget is just short of 300 million, it's 299 million. The bulk of the budget is allocated to cost of expenditure, and this is mainly the case because the nature of our service is knowledge-based and expertise-based. We talk about legal advisors, content advisors, and the committee support, and we have a small operational budget of 66 million, of which 40 million is allocated to committees. So here's a further breakdown. And I need to indicate to members that there's a small error on your, it's not a small error, it's a big error. The PDO central office, the budget is not 8 million, it's 800,000 in fact, so I apologize for that error. I think we wish we had the 8 million, the extra zero there. So committees take a large portion of the operational budget. There's a committee section at 10.6, so that covers the cost of committee staff in relation to their support for all the activities of committees. Then we have the legal services office at 12 million, and then the office supporting the leader of government business has a small budget of 150,000, my office at 450,000. And then between the parliamentary democracy offices and the public education office, we're looking at a total of just over 5.4 million that is allocated for public participation activities. And then we have just provided a breakdown on CAPEX. It's not a big budget. It's mainly to ensure that we are able to have the requisite equipment to support the functions that we perform. I think our core challenge is funding linked to positions, the lack of human resources, freezing of posts. Does place extra pressure on staff and can impact on staff morale. Also delays in recruitment processes, and then I think the key factor that has emerged over the last year is the uncertainty around the organizational structure and the anxiety that has introduced on staff. In terms of opportunities, I think we shouldn't just focus on the negative. We do have a wealth of expertise and experience amongst our staff, and some of them who's been partnered for a number of years. Also the capacity for providing senior support service to committees in the houses, and we have seen that in a number of our activities, particularly in the fifth parliament. And then the review of key frames, particularly the oversight and accountability model, the development of new models to assist members in the performance of their or the execution of their mandates on the fairly advanced stage. And then we also have staff that are fairly committed and willing to go the next amount. I just added a lot of time to indicate who the more bodies are in the respective offices. I don't know if there's more gender representatives than any other area, but these are the key managers that report to me in my division. The section manager committee is all vacant. We are in the process of recruiting, and we have the chief legal advisor, and the role in the OROGB is vacant, and then Thomas has just joined us this year as the public education manager. Thank you.
Thank you, madam. Members? Same reason? It's Shari? Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Beg, and thank you very much. I think that I would start by agreeing with the last point on your slide, and that we are very lucky to have employees in this parliament who are willing to go the extra mile and who really do make this place work, and we should be very grateful for them. I think that one of the things that I believe is missing with the oversight and the accountability model particularly is the work that was done by the high-level panel report. And I think we can praise the high-level panel report for the work that was done. But in essence, it's actually an indictment of Parliament, because it's work that I think we should have done as both an NA and NCOP. And that's to assess the impact of the legislation which we passed in the House. And I think we must be grateful for the work that the high-level panel did. But I think it's a salutary wake-up call to Parliament that we need to find some mechanism to acknowledge the impact of the legislation that we pass. So far too often, we pass a piece of legislation, once it's been assented to, we essentially wash our hands of it, and you know, nobody's checking up on what the impact, the effect has had, whether it's met the targets that were set out in the original memorandum that accompanied the motivation for the legislation to be passed, whether there's been unintended consequences of that piece of legislation, etc. So I really think it's something we're going to have to move towards in the sixth parliament. Because what we don't want to have to do is in 10 years' time have another high-level panel report that points out these unintended consequences and lack of implementation. And I don't know how we're going to do it, given your staff constraints, the budget constraints, but I think it is going to be something that we do move towards, assessing the impact of legislation that we pass, so that we are monitoring constantly whether it's achieving the intended consequences. If not, what amendments can we make? How can we adjust the law to fix the unintended consequences or the gaps that have been created? I think it's more a comment than a request for question, but I think it is something we're going to have to do.
Thank you, Chair, again. Next week, the NCOP committees are having their strategy planning session. I would like to invite you. In fact, I'm not the one supposed to invite, but I wish you could also attend. Yesterday we had the chairpersons of committees, select committees. They were concerned that we were raised to the staff mentioned the fact that with regard to legal services, we had to drag some legal service staff to come to committees to give advice, legal advice to the committee. So I don't know whether how then in terms of monitoring, for example, when in terms of the checklist, you know what programs are taking place in each of the committees. This particular committee will be dealing with the legislation. Whether in terms of your monitoring, you will be sure whether then there is legal advice that is provided for such a committee that is dealing with the legislation. Two, the content advice, whether there are any monitoring mechanism to when committees are meeting, whether content advice, written advice, has been provided to such committee. Honorable Tim will tell you, we are serving in the same committee. We had a committee this morning. There was nothing in terms of research work, analysis, or content advice, and it's something that is regular. When we are lucky, we would get that information on the in the afternoon before the next day for the meeting. So that I'm concerned about the monitoring. I'm not saying the what you have in paper is not true, but I want to emphasize the issue of monitoring, whether these things are happening, but also the quality. Yesterday I raised the issue of the quality of meetings, but I'm now raising the issue of the quality of the research work. Sometimes if you're talking about an APP or annual report, it's just a repeat of what the department is saying. There's no analysis except a repeat of what the department are saying. So you might as well just look at the APP of the department and leave out the advice or the research analysis that is made by the researchers or content advisor. So the emphasis again, please monitor this. Monitor the issue of minutes. We had a meeting on Tuesday. I can tell you by Friday, we won't have the minister be talking about. Thank you, Chair.
Your challenges, they are a reflection of HR. But HR, if we have staff with low morale, then it means what you said about the wellness support and all that, it's just a documented policy, it's not in practice. But your challenges can be resolved. They're temporary, they're not permanent. If we just work together. Because if you were working together with HR, you would have been able to identify what are the things that they were able to resolve. So your slide on challenges is just it says a lot about HR, and it cancels all the positive things that they've said about the support that they're giving to staff members, the turnaround time in terms of dealing with vacancies and all that. It changes the whole picture. So we are starting, it's fine. In the next presentations, we want presentations that will have synergy because we are a team and we work together. So we don't want divisions that are working in silos. We want to get a flow. If HR says this, then everybody else should agree with HR says. It's just a point for noting. Thanks.
But nevertheless, I'm just asking myself to take here. In my previous life, you asked for at a committee level to say the portfolio committee would love to have a meeting on this day. And then you get a response that says, we can't. But it's fine because there's nothing that you can't if you are inhaling oxygen, you can do. That's the willingness and the mind. That's not an issue. But the issue that I'm raising, I want to come to. Based on the previous presentation that we received, which I was
seeing papers to say what makes this unit to be so married to paper processing of requesting decided decisions of the portfolio committee in terms of city. The turnaround time seems like, ish, we're going to go to heaven and come back and tomorrow and we're scared, we're not too sure what heaven holds for us. And so it's based on the personal experience at the portfolio committees that I've served, because I've served in more than two committees, fortunately enough, so I'm not specific. But I think if you look at that and say, how do we best deal with the turnaround, even the issues of applying for the oversight? It tends to be paper process. If that paper gets lost, everything is lost. So you have to start all over again. We can't be parliament that wants to be parliament and oversight on the department. Honorable Chair, and expect their turnaround to be 2 minutes and ours is 4 minutes. There's something that is not like, or the department yesterday that makes a presence in terms of the, what is what they call them, that deal with the technology, ICT. It seems like Honorable Co-Chair Mother was talking to say that it seems like we're a client of ourselves. We're not client of the institution as it were. We support each other and are then at that level, at a high strategic level, then we're able then to execute the efficiency and the effective in terms of the service that we provide to ourselves in life. So I'm thinking that taking that as not responsible to say, let us then look at that, the turnaround and the papers that are floating all over the show, that I think is very serious change. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Member. Can we get a response?
Thank you, Co-Chair Dixon, and thank you, Honourable Members. Honourable Skinner, I think we've learned many lessons out of the HRP report. I think as a starting point, we've looked at our committee programs for, at least for the sixth parliament. And part of the committee programs will incorporate oversight of the implementation of legislation that has been passed. Together with that, we are developing, or we are in the process of putting together a legislative framework for each portfolio. So committees can have an idea of what legislation impacts on our portfolio, which legislation have we passed recently, and then as part of the committee program, then to identify which pieces of legislation or the implementation thereof are we going to oversee in a particular year. So there were definitely lessons learned, and I keep on saying that we've all looked at the oversight clause in the Constitution, but we lost sight of that last part, which is including the implementation of legislation. So it's certainly a focus. Also in terms of a draft revised oversight and accountability model that features quite prominently in the model, that it is an area that we will need to have dedicated oversight over. I have been invited to the NCFP strategic committee strategic planning session. We are in fact preparing for that session next week. I am aware of the concerns that unfortunately I couldn't attend the chair's meeting due to other commitments. I am aware of the concerns that were raised, and I've met with committee management today so that we can try and resolve some of those concerns. I do need to indicate there was an induction session for the NA chairperson. Some of those topics that featured in the chair meetings yesterday was discussed. So it would have been good if we had that joint induction session, but I could understand that the NTOP had a program to run, and I have suggested that we do schedule that induction session for the chairpersons of the NTOP. In terms of the treatment of the NTOP vis-a-vis the NA, I've made reference to a model that we are working on, the cooperative governance oversight mechanism. And what that model seeks to do is to place the NA, to identify what is the core focus of the NCOP in terms of its oversight function and constitutionally mandated function, and what it is that the NA should focus on. And we hope that that finds traction, that we are able to raise the, not the status, but raise the way we people view the NCOP. In terms of the staff member, the legal advice to committees, if you've seen on the slide, we've got 10 legal advisors in legal services and three senior legal advisors that work in the legal services section. And
that vis-a-vis the number of committees, if we look at the sectors, it becomes difficult to allocate staff. So the chief legal advisor will allocate staff based on what is on the sectors. If there's a specific request or specific concern, then committees can, particularly at the management, the management meetings, it would be useful to then indicate that there is a real need for a legal advisor to be present. But it's difficult at this stage to invite the total staff component that we have there amongst all the committees, especially when there's committees in the NA and the NCOP that are meeting. But it's something we will look at. I will raise it with the chief legal advisor and see how we can address that going forward. In terms of quality of research, I think we can park that question when this gentleman presents. But I think we share the same issue in terms of the quality of the content advice and the quality of research. I think the structure in research services holds better in terms of doing an assessment, because they do have senior researchers and chief researcher. The structure for content advisors is slightly different, and it's something that we're going to look at in the institutional realignment to see if there are concerns in that area, how we can improve on it. The challenges, Chair, I wouldn't necessarily agree that it is a reflection of HR. I think the first point that I raised is the funding, and the funding is linked to the freezing of posts. And if you don't have money to fill posts, you can't fill the posts. So it's not HR. I think it's how Parliament is funded as an institution and how we receive that funding. The fact that we also go cap in hand with all other departments and we choose the same as departments, I think that's the core issue. Yeah, so we are not fighting with our colleagues in HR. They're trying their best to assist us. But the limitation starts with the budget and which budget is available. The issue about paper, I think the My Parliament, I'm not sure whether the members have been briefed on the My Parliament app. The whole purpose of developing that app was for us to go paperless, so that we have less paper in committee meetings, less paper in the houses, and that all the documentation that's required for committees and houses are distributed on the system. So that is a key project of Parliament that our ICT team has worked on. Because Parliament is in the fifth consultation, did make this a priority that we need to spend less on paper and take care of our environment. So that is something that we are going to work on. I know that committee is currently equal paper driven. It's a change management process to get people. I'm a legal person, so I need a piece of paper and pen, so I also need to be really orientated. I understand it is a change in behavior that we need to look at. The time for the applications, this is something that also came up in the National Assembly induction session that we had with chairpersons. And we will have a discussion around with the House chairpersons to see how we can streamline, because there's two-step process. First that we obtain political approval and then we do a funding application. We want to see how we can merge those processes into one, and that will obviously assist us in terms of time. Just a comment on ICT. ICT strategy is focused on providing support to the core business of Parliament. So in yesterday's presentation, you would have seen they are working on a number of application developments to support core business, the development of the e-petition system, the e-submission system. Now, the e-submission system, we've asked them to focus on the NDPOP taking part into the people, which gives citizens an opportunity to submit their petition online and to get feedback on it. We've asked them to extend that to the rulemaking process, so that we can get input into a role via the system. What makes it difficult, and we've learned this from the CRC process, is when you have to do a report on who has commented and what the comments were, then you need staff to pull together, say, 700 submissions that you've received. And if we use an electronic system, it would make our lives that much easier to get them accessible to the community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This process is not a court process where anyone's going to be found guilty, but we're trying to improve
and there's no need for you to protect HR, because now you want us to enter into a debate about what are the roles of HR. So I don't want us to deter into that level. So we're not here to protect anyone. We're not here to accuse anyone of any wrongdoing, but we want our systems to be in place so that Parliament flourishes and able to serve both members and staff members. So we are starting, I think it's for the first time that members of the leadership of Parliament sit before the committee. But now getting into this, this is now how we're going to start doing things. You're going to be subjected to this process. So it's not a court process, but it's a process where members of Parliament, yes, we are improving accountability. Because if people don't account, then it means there won't be any services, there won't be any improvement. So get used to this, ma'am, and please don't protect yourself. We are here to improve and to make each other's work better, and also to be able to identify issues of common interest where you can be able to support one another and avoid duplication. So it's all about that. All right. Can we get the Knowledge and Information Service Division? Gabriel?
Thank you, Honourable Co-Chairperson, and good evening, Honourable Members. My name is Leon Gabriel. I lead the Division of Knowledge and Information Services. And just at the outset, Honourable Co-Chair, let me just apologise. I'm nursing a bit of a cold today. So if my voice sounds a bit croaky, it's for that reason. Just to start in terms of the scope of the presentation, like my colleagues, I have a high-level presentation that will deal with the purpose of knowledge and information services. We look at the objectives linked to the strategic objectives. I have an education of organogram with the whole division. I have given some detailed information on the roles, functions, and the staff establishment. Some of the key output and costs specifically as requested by this committee. And then we will look at some of the high-level challenges that are related to particularly to budget matters. So the next slide then begins to illustrate the purpose of the division. On the high level, the Knowledge and Information Services Division is responsible for strategic leadership, development, promotion and dissemination of knowledge and information in support of the core business of Parliament through the work of committees and members of Parliament. This includes a variety of services and products, amongst them the knowledge development, knowledge collaboration and knowledge sharing initiatives. We provide research services, both reactive and proactive, not only for committees of Parliament, but also to individual members of Parliament. So this is a non-partisan service, accessible to all members of all parties. We are responsible for the provision of interpreting services in all 11 official languages of South Africa, and South African Sign Language. This, at this point, is provided primarily in plenary settings of the Houses, and in some committees, depending on where the capacity allows, particularly relating to public participation activities of committees. The next slide continues with the purpose and products and services of the division. We are also responsible for the production of the Hansard report, or the official verbatim report of the sittings of the Houses. And then also translation of daily papers and other official parliamentary publications. The documentation section within the division is responsible for electronic document management, or commonly referred to as the Uvimba system. And just to touch on what Ms. Begg reported on in terms of the My Parliament app, so we provide the back-end document management system for that application. The Library of Parliament is also within the Knowledge and Information Services Division. We are one of five legal public libraries in South Africa, so we receive all South African publications free of charge through the Legal Deposit Act. And the library is a full library service. It is a specialist library, so in other words, we focus our collection primarily on the work of focus areas of committees and individual interests of members of Parliament. But we also have an interlibrary of the Knowledge and Information Services Division, just in terms of key outputs, grouped into three broad areas: research, information, and analysis, which comprises the research services and the library of content primarily. Then we have professional multilingual communication services, which comprises interpreting and translation services. And then within the knowledge creation and organization paradigm, we include document management and the production of the Hansard report. Within that knowledge management area is also the knowledge sharing, knowledge creation, and codification across the institution. The next slide is an indication of the organogram of the Knowledge and Information Services Division. We do have a total of 255 staff. 129 of those are in language services. And the division comprises four sections: the language services section, which has three units, the reporting unit responsible for the Hansard report, translations unit for translation, as I indicated, and the interpreting unit for simultaneous and all consecutive interpreting. The research unit comprises of 60 staff. That includes mostly researchers and senior researchers, and then we have a continuum of administrative assistants that support five clusters in that unit. The Parliamentary Information Centre, or otherwise Library of Parliament, has four subunits: the reference subunit, which is the frontline service of the library, and then the back office or the back end dealing with rare and historical materials, including the artworks, some of the artworks collections of Parliament, processing and indexing, and then acquisitions and serial. The documentation section includes the clerk of papers for tabling of parliamentary documents or official tabling, as well as document management, as I've indicated, electronic document management, and document technical services, which is the internal printing function of Parliament. The next slide just gives an indication of the high-level operational plan, and I have not given in this presentation the details of the operational technical descriptive indicators and targets for the division, but that information is available if required. On the next slide, I've given a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet that details the staff establishment that's all for 255 staff in the division. As I said, 126 of those are in language services. We have 36 employees in the Library of Parliament, 60 employees in research, 29 employees in the documentation section, and 4 in the Office of the Division Manager. The next slide, Honorable Co-Chairperson, indicates the key output costs. The total budget of the division for the 2019-20 financial year is 188.4 million rand. This is disaggregated on this slide into key output areas, and then I also have indicated costs in terms of the economic classification. So if we look first at the research, information, and analysis output area, we can see that it comprises, as I said, the two areas of research and analysis and information, which is the Library of Parliament and the Research Unit. And of that, the library has an allocation of 26.1 million rand and the research 50.3 million rand. On the next slide, the economic classification in terms of that same area of output. As members can see, the bulk of expenditure goes to compensation of employees. So that is the employment of professional staff, so 92% of that budget and 8% for operations. Look at the area of professional multilingual communication services. So that includes interpreting services and translation. So a total budget of 57.87 million rand for those functions, 34 million rand to interpreting services, 23.7 million rand to translation. In terms of economic classification, again, a very similar pattern. So 99% of that budget allocation goes to compensation of employees. So that's the employment of professional language practitioners, and then 1% of that budget to operational. The third area that deals with knowledge creation and organization. Hansard report. The Hansard is produced by language practitioners as well, and that comprises 20.4 million rand of this budget allocation, and a very similar allocation to documentation of 24.9 million. In terms of economic classification for this area of work, 85% goes to compensation of employees, 12% to operational expenditure, and 3% to capital expenditure for this financial year. The next slide, I've highlighted the high-level challenges that have budget implications. Within the research area, we do not have a dedicated budget for empirical research, so the research that is provided from the Parliamentary Research Unit is secondary research or desktop research for the most part. We do have opportunities to do a small amount of primary research or empirical research as the resources would allow. Then we also do not have adequate allocations of budget for technical equipment and tools of trade in terms of introducing new technologies and new tools of trade. And this particularly impacts on language services in terms of interpreting booths in some of the facilities in Parliament, such as this chamber, for example, the digital recording and transcription system, and then the introduction of new translation software to assist with electronic translation. And then similar to Ms. Begg, I have also indicated the impact of reduction in the budget baseline that affected primarily compensation line items. And we do have a number of unfunded vacancies, so this is not included in the HR indication of vacancy rate. But I've given an indication of the total number of unfunded vacancies within the division, and just aggregated them according to the different sections in the division. And I'll stop there.
Thank you. Okay. No questions.
The process of Monica, I think all of this is the same with regard to everything. Also, the girl can be invited also to the first next meeting. But yesterday I also read the issue of the press leader was referred to this particular division. But I was indicating that you can only access when you are here in Parliament, outside Parliament. Like legislators who can access president outside Parliament. Perhaps we could get response to that. So, thanks.
Yeah, Dr. Gero, have you been challenges with Hansard and keeping up to date with where we are in Hansard? You just go into what the challenges of Hansard are, things.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think the first point that the Honourable Chair are going to raise. Secondly, Chair, in terms of translation capacity, we are, Honourable Co-Chair, introducing the mini-plenary in relation to NA in particular. If we then were finding ourselves a little bit limited in that, for me, my area of interest, not only languages, but also in terms of the sign languages in way, then I probably, moving forward, I must look at that as this control committee to say, how do we champion that? When we plan this mini plenary, they talk to that as well. I know when there's a sitting in both houses, there's a sign language interpreter, but for the public. But let's say there's a like when it's tomorrow, we're going to this to have a women's parliament. I wonder whether it's going to be, or it's going to be there because there's a senior executive members that are going to partake in that activity or not. But I'm saying as the institution that wants to reach out and close the social gap as it were in terms of all the business that we
powers may be in terms of investing in that resource space as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Co-Chairperson, and thank you, Honourable Members, for those questions. Just in terms of the monitoring, that's the point you've taken. Like Ms. Beck, I have also received a letter of invitation from Honourable Nyambi to attend the planning of the NCRP committee next week. So I will be there, and I will be bringing along the chief researcher as well as the section manager language services to those sessions. In terms of press reader access, I'm sure that the difficulties have been a technical problem. Because really, we should be able to, all members should be able to access press reader from anywhere in the world. It is a web-based system, so I will take the matter up with the head of the library and get somebody to come and have a meeting with you just to look at whether there were technical problems around that area. And we'll look at it more broadly in terms of access and when the system is done, as it were. And work closely with ICT on that. The challenges with Hansard, the operational target for Hansard is that we produce the unrevised Hansard report within 5 days of the sitting. And we have, through operational efficiencies and looking critically at the operational processes within the reporting unit, been able to shift performance in that target from 35% 2 or 3 years ago to consistently about 95% and close to 99% over the last few financial years. The difficulty and challenge comes in particularly around the period of the mini plenary. So it does not only affect interpreting services and particularly where venues are used where there are no technical facilities equipped in those venues. So we have to procure those in for that period at a considerable cost. But during that period, we do have some challenges around that 5-day turnaround for the production transfer. So that affects the reporting on performance in accordance with that 5-day target. But that does not mean that the unrevised transfer is not produced in its entirety after the 5 days. So often it's 6 days or 7 days and sometimes a little bit beyond. Downstream from that is the process of then producing the volumes of Hansard, which is the consolidated volumes of a particular term of parliament. And at the moment we are, for example, finalizing the 5-year term of the first parliament in terms of the full Hansard production. But the unrevised Hansard is produced and published on the website in unrevised form within 5 days for the most part. At least 99% of performance on that. Translation capacity, again, as the Honourable Member has indicated, related primarily to the many plenaries, but not only to that. So even if we're looking at the translation of daily papers and a truly multilingual processes and systems and documents in Parliament, we're very far off the mark in terms of what is required and what we should be doing. We have had begun discussions now with the management within language services to say we are aware of any plenaries happening year on year and that we should have a standard strategy and plan for that that will just roll up during that period every year. So whether we enter into an enabling contract with freelance translators, for example, or whatever the most cost-effective method is, and that's what we should put in place as a standing arrangement, particularly for that period of money centering, and we envisage that is going to increase the performance and the services during that period. On parliamentary events such as the Women's Parliament, we are part of the planning team for this, and fortunately for this Women's Parliament on the 29th, we have lines of language services, including sign language interpreter for that particular event. However, we have, for interpreting services, worked on a minimum standard or requirement of at least 4 language practitioners per language. That means that if both houses are sitting concurrently, we have at least 2 members of staff interpreting in the booth per language. And that works for a period of when that is possible with two members of staff per language, granted that we haven't had any staff members calling in ill or not being available for other reasons. But the moment we have more than two consecutive sittings, then we do have challenges in terms of the numbers of staff. So again, that's the matter that we're looking at in terms of how we maximize the current resources across the language services section, and not just work in those specific units of interpreting, translation, and reporting, but looking at how we develop the capacity to have a multi-skilled language practitioner that might may be able to move amongst those three areas of language support. So that's one of the strategies that we are looking at.
I was surprised to find out that committee meetings are not recorded. We only rely on the minutes by committee secretary. Today I heard that there's a case on a particular legislation that was dealt with in a portfolio committee where the allegation was that the chairperson of the committee was not giving other members of the committee opportunity to express their views. Now, relying on minutes, in court without any recording electronically of the proceedings of that particular portfolio committee meeting, I'm sure it's going to create a problem. Unless it was a visual recorded, which is not always the case in some of the committees, particularly the committees that must be open. The reason also why PMG's minutes, the quality, is because also they have they got this small, I don't know what they call it, recording the devices. So when they go back, then to deal with the minutes, they listen to those devices, and then that's why when they write minutes, everything went forward. So that it improves their quality. Because I don't know if there's a possibility of also having such. Because I was of the opinion that because I'm speaking on this. Or automatically, therefore, it is recorded. I was surprised when the committee secretary was telling me, no, this is just for you, so that everybody can hear you. It will be audible. Not that it is recording what you say. Yeah. So, yeah.
Thank you,
Jay.
Just to pick up the my issue was also
on
the minutes, because I was about KPMG. Legal relationship with Parliament is in way. PMG, okay, yeah, PMG. To say, where does it fit in the whole scheme of issues and also in terms of exactly what the Honourable Member is saying? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Co-Chair. On the issue of recording of meetings, so from the provision of the verbatim report, which we regard as the Hansard report, we do not have the capacity, and it is not one of the mandates of the division to provide a verbatim report of committee proceedings. There are plenaries of the House. But having said that, most of the venues, committee meeting venues, have the microphones, and not all of them, but most of them have facilities, if on request by the chairperson or through the chairperson, that meetings could be recorded. But it's not, as the honourable member has correctly indicated, it's not an automatic thing that if microphones are on, the meeting is recorded. If, for example, the committee decides to have a closed meeting, they can still use microphones and not record the meeting. Verbatim or record it and keep those records for the committee's use only. But that is a matter that between Ms. Beg and I and our discussions with ICT and Sound and Vision, we can take up in terms of looking at with In terms of PMG, we don't have any legal relationship with PMG, but except to regard PMG as one of those NGOs, as it were, that has an interest in parliamentary proceedings and parliamentary activities and have records of those. We do subscribe to the PMG databases and websites or web access services through the Library of Parliament. So, and it's a small subscription fee that we pay every year so that we can access PMG resources as well. So that's as far as the relationship with PMG goes in terms of this division and Parliament broadly.
Thank you. Maybe on the issue of the corners, I think we should actually invest in just your little digital recording, I don't know what do they call them, there's a website, got it, predictable. Because in terms of infrastructure of this institution, there are commitments that will never be able to carry the new AVs, the wiring of these old things. And you may find that some of these rooms are so old that you can't even say AV will be installed. So, but what I think the member is saying, the Baberton recorder is just highly predictable. And then we gave to committee. We just give them the notes and give them and make sure we carry them all the time. That's all we must do. In the meantime, we'll look at the other things how to. But that is a record that we must keep. We must just do it.
Okay. It's 1951. So there's no